Thank you. Thank you for the kind introduction. This is the plan I would like to walk through, tell you about motivation, what exactly is Dusty Plasma plasmas are all about. But I would like to also encourage you that if I say something that is incorrect or needs explanation, feel free to interrupt during the talk, and I will certainly happy to talk to you afterwards. So, a couple of slides to make you excited why you're going to spend here the next 45 or so minutes. I will give you a little bit of introduction to the subject. Then I will probably just focus on one aspect of it, what happens on surfaces that are exposed to solar wind and ultraviolet radiation, and I will end up showing you the instrument that we built for this mission and conclude the talk. So wherever you look, certainly, I understand that you rarely teach your plasma physics for your graduates or undergrads. But if you look around in the universe, you see many places where plasma physics is important at all scales, even in the Earth's atmosphere, and many of you are doing atmospheric physics here. Noctuation clouds were often argued that's also a good place to learn about dusty plasmas, where radars are reflected very strongly, indicating strong charge density changes, large gradients in charge densities, mobile charge densities. Probably electrons are sitting on aerosols, making a big bite out in electron density. But most of the time when you look at these places, you realize certainly a comet would be a good example, noctuation clouds as well, that it's not a pure electron and ion plasma. There are massive charge carriers. Dust or aerosol or ice crystals or some other species that are much more massive than your standard charge carriers of electrons and ions. And I will tell you why that is interesting for basic plasma physics. Before I do that, this is the chart of the plasma universe. I show you the temperature on a logarithmic scale and the density on a logarithmic scale. And these are the typical places where one can look for dusty plasmas, the Earth's ionosphere. Flames are certainly a good place where soot and electrons and ions commingle, low pressure discharges. Even our colleagues who do infusion research often argue about problems that involve dust particles in the plasma due to hitting the walls of a fusion device and knocking off solid particles. That is a headache for fusion research. Of course, there are other places that you could go to, like inside of a star, where dust is unlikely to play any roles. So, plasma physics in general, of course, has to do with electrons and ions. And the interesting part, of course, is the story when they communicate with one another. Their collective behavior can generate waves, can generate instabilities, and study plasma physics for a living. And things would be different if you now put in a dust particle that is very massive. And it can absorb or, in some cases, release electrons and ions on its own, changing the energy distribution, changing the composition, changing everything that you learned about the plasma. Not to mention that if I put in like a micron-sized particle, which is an elephant in the sea of little ants, or even that is a wrong example, its charge almost becomes a continuum variable. You can only ionize oxygen 8 times, but you could steal away millions and millions of electrons from a micron-sized dust particle or put extra million electrons on it. Of course, the charge states are still quantized. I cannot give you half an electron, but I can give you a whole lot or I can steal a whole lot away from you. It's becoming even more interesting where these dust particles, there's enough of them that they communicate to one another. They are not single particles that are immersed in a sea of electrons and ions, but they notice that there are dust particles around me. They do have a charge, and they feel each other's electric field and presence. So now you can have waves and instabilities that appear in the dust itself, in the dust fluid or the dust particles themselves would talk to each other. So if I look around in nature, I can see regions in space where electrons coexist with a whole lot of ions, positive and negative particles at the same time. A comet or rings of Saturn would be a good example where that is the case. Or you could actually just start with a dusty surface and shine light on it. It will generate electrons due to the photoelectric effect, and then you have electrons and positively charged dust particles. That would be another example. Or moon would be, so first approximation described like that. Or you could actually start with no plasma at all. Just have a region where there's a lot of collisions between dust particles. And due to triboelectric charging, when there is a collision, little guys tend to steal away electrons from the big guys. For example, if you look at this volcanic outburst, where there is a strong uplift, which is probably moving small particles much faster than bigger ones, there's a lot of collisions, little guys steal away the electrons, and you mechanically separate the big guys from the little guys, you build up charge separation, you build up an electric field, and no loose electron then can gain enough energy between collisions to make an electron avalanche. And then you can have a discharge, the same volcano taken the image at night. So where is the physics? Where is this exciting from basic plasma physics point of view is the new scales, both in space and time, what is being introduced. If you ever looked at the charts or colleagues that do plasma waves produce, on one axis is probably time, on the other axis is power in waves that have frequencies of megahertz and gigahertz, and they all can produce wiggly lines, how the power spectrum of the various wave activity is changing as a function of time and space as the spacecraft is flying through. Now, a dust particle is so massive, then if I compare it, how long it would take to gyrate, if it would gyrate at all, compared to how long does it take for an electron and ion to gyrate a field line, it's a whole different universe. If I ask you what sort of waves you expect, all of a sudden the waves are downshifted in frequency and upshifted in wavelengths to human scales. And in the next slide I will show you a plasma wave that you could see for yourself. That is unheard of in plasma physics. Typically we stick in an antenna, isn't it? And we see how the electric field is changing in time. And we could spend a whole lot of arguments about how do I estimate how much charge there will be on the dust particle. As a first step, that would be perhaps the most important way it will couple into the sea of electrons and ions that it collect charge or loose charges. You have to figure out how you formulate the loss of electrons and ions or the gain of these reaching the surface. If an electron has enough energy that would hit the surface, it can generate secondary electrons to leave. If you shine photons on it, you can make photoelectrons. Or in regions where dust and dust collides, you could also generate charging that way. And here it is. This is a dust acoustic wave. This is a longitudinal wave. Actually, it was predicted first in 1990 and then observed at University of Iowa in 95. That's one of the first images. You could see these bright lines evolving slowly in time. These are regions where there's a lot of light being scattered. There's a lot of dust, followed by lulls and highs and lulls and highs in dust density. It's an acoustic wave. And the only way that these particles are coupled to one another, they notice one another, is through their charge. So look at the wavelength, the centimeter. The frequency of these typically are into seconds. So you could see plasma waves, dusty plasma waves, with your naked eye. All right, so I will not show a whole lot of equations, just maybe.
Was that a lab? Sorry, did you call it a lab right there?
Yes.
Okay.
How they set this up?
Yeah.
That's a beautiful question. So, on Earth, it's really hard to keep plasma and dust together. That's gravity. I can make a plasma discharge, a DC plasma with a filament on one side, biasing that against the wall of the device, spraying electron into a neutral gas, and maintain a DC plasma. Now, if I put in dust and I want to make it visible, it has to be 50 micron, 100 micron, and that would just fall down. So they built a device with a rotating drum. So they put in dust, it falls in at the bottom, and the drum keeps rotating. And the dust is put in this device at all times. And in this experiment, actually, there's a neutral gas flow across. And these waves you see in the outlet from the rotating drums in the plasma machine. But yes, these issues, dusty plasma waves are hard because the dust, at least, Earth's gravity would not stay in the volume of the plasma. All right, so here it is. It's a big dust particle, just one at a time. But for now, it's only one of the particles. Electrons are coming, and ions are coming, and photons are coming. And of course, once you are near or at equilibrium, when I add up all these currents, they better add up to be zero. So the flux of electrons bringing in negative charges, the flux of ions, positive charges. Secondaries, which is a positive current, electrons are leaving. Photoelectrons, positive current, electrons are leaving. That all sums up to be zero. And we could try to argue what's the simplest way that I could formulate this. And that is just doing a Coulomb cross-section. I have an electron and ion approaching a big charge. And I figure out from the conservation of energy and momentum what is the cross-section, whether it's increased or reduced due to the attractive or repulsive force between the charge that is coming towards the dust particle. That's exactly, I believe, that you did in mechanics for gravity, or you did in ENM, the Rutherford formula. You might have seen this kind of problem many times. And it starts out that let's make this to be negatively charged. If I only have electrons and ions, the mobility of electrons, even if they have the same temperature as ions, is 40 times higher than the ion mobility. So there will be many more electrons coming initially to the surface as ions do. Just the mass ratio is 2,000. The square root of that is about 40. So the flux initially is 40 times higher. Some of those electrons will stick. The grain starts negatively charged. The electrons with the least energetic electrons will have a hard time reaching the surface now. The electron flux is reduced. The ion flux is enhanced because it's an attractive potential now. And when the two becomes in balance, then you are in charge of equilibrium. So you will be negatively charged. So the first term is just the electron charge, the density, and that will be the thermal temperature, and that is the reduced cross-section because it's a repulsive force and the surface area, and this is the enhancement of the standard formulation for energy and angular momentum for the attractive potential between an incoming ion and a negatively charged dust particle. You could make these two equal, and the outcome is, at least for a hydrogen plasma, it turns out that the equilibrium potential, the surface potential with respect to zero at infinity, is going to be 2.5 times the electron temperature or the ion temperature. They are the same. That was first worked out by Spitzer, who is, any of you do astrophysics, that result might be familiar. I can turn that into a relationship between the charge and the surface potential. Actually, I didn't even capture that the surface potential is 2.5 times the plasma temperature, but just the way the unit worked out on a micron-sized particle, a surface potential of 1 volt with respect to zero far away plasma or zero at infinity means that you have an extra or missing 700 electrons. That's how the units work out. So here is the first plasma experiment. The only side note that I would like to show you that this was done probably 30 years ago by the daughter of Wing Ip, who was one of the guys who started to discuss plasma physics, dusty plasma physics, for the first time. So I like to carry this around as one of the initial contributions to dusty plasma experiments. We have done one, which is really simple. Again, here is a little filament that we run a current through. It becomes very hot, and it will boil off electrons. It is biased against the wall, so these electrons will spray into the volume. We attach a salt shaker on top and try to get rid of one single dust particle at a time. Typically, they are 50 or 60 microns in diameter, so the charge they will collect is easy to measure. The dust particle will fall through the plasma generated by these electrons sprayed into the background gas and ionize it. The dust particle falls into a Faraday cup, where we measure the charge it brings in. And here I will just show you for one setup. Typically, the plasma temperature is on the order of an electron volt or so. The plasma densities are maybe 10 to the 10, 10 to the 11 per cubic centimeter. And as a function of the diameter of the dust particle, this is the charge that we measure. In this setup, we measured millions of electrons. And the bigger the particle, the more electrons it collects, exactly as that little formula I showed you one slide before would predict. The other parameter I could change is the bias potential. What should be the energy of the electrons as they come in? And what happens is, if you make the electron energy higher and higher, the charge that you collect gets larger and larger, up to a point. And if you do your experiment with graphite particles, that point happens somewhere around 100 electron volt or so, then something strange happens. If you do it with glass, that strangeness happens earlier. You lose the linear relationship, because in addition, just collecting electrons and ions from the background plasma, if you overdo it, if you give the electrons too much energy, you start producing secondary electrons. There is yet another process at play, and that would somewhat discharge the particles as they force through the plasma. You could do this experiment instead of having a filament and the plasma, is buy an expensive quartz window, shine a UV light so it can get through the quartz window, and repeat the experiment. And this is the spectral distribution of the light that we produced. It's a mercury discharge arc lamp. It's about a kilowatt energy that it is using, and it's a few percentile of that turns into UV light. And depending on the work function of the material that we drop, whether it's graphite or copper or zinc, we can measure the positive charges due to the photoelectric effect on single dust particles. All right, now this is it. Now I convince you that we could figure out the charge. I didn't convince you, but please take my word for it. We could work out something about waves. But now I would like to go to surfaces. And the first surface I'd like to show you is the lunar surface. And of course, we were there. This is Apollo 16, glorious. You should be almost at tears how good we were 30 or 40 years ago. And the only piece of physics that I would have pointed out to you is this huge, huge rooster tails left behind as the wheels are turning on the surface. And by the way, if any of you is into undergraduate teaching, here is a teaching moment. Those rooster tails are individual dust particles. They follow ballistic motion, and you could actually work out from the size of the wheel, from the position of the spoke of the wheel, how fast this thing is moving, how fast the dust particles are knocked out, and what is the arc that little patch of dirt or a cloud of dust particles follows. And we have done that analysis. Actually, an undergraduate student has done that analysis. Here it is. I can tell you that the gravity on the lunar surface is about 1.6 meters per second squared. Actually, it turns out, and that's again a beautiful teaching moment, that if you were to run your camera faster and you would try to cheat, do this on Earth, the initial speed and gravity and the timing between the frames, the shape can be manipulated. The shape, you could reproduce the shape with different gravity, running the camera at different rates and reporting to me somewhat different delta t's than you did. So maybe NASA did cheat, but then you would say, wait a minute, can you do this if there is drag? And these small particles would certainly, if you were to do it on Earth, there is drag. And this would be the trajectory, the green lines, and the pointers is weak, but these are the green lines for 100 micron and the 200 micron parabola if you were to do that at one atmospheric pressure. Now you would tell me that NASA built a gigantic vacuum chamber. All right, sometimes it's not so glorious. This is Apollo 17. This is the movie that is less frequently shown by my colleagues at the various NASA centers, but what I would like to point out to you is look how dirty he remains. It's an incredibly difficult environment. Dust gets in everything. Things don't click, things don't close, things don't work. It is like working in a coal mine. So the idea that we're gonna go and live there for long periods, you have major issues with dust that you should worry about. But the rest of the talk, I would like to address things that happen without people there. Certainly there's a lot of applications, a lot of interest in the engineering applications of dust and plasma behavior on the surface. But I would like to shy away for now with people involved. and worry about the moon as an object exposed to UV and solar wind plasma. And what I will tell you, there's a cartoon from the early 70s, and there's a cartoon from a couple of years ago. Other than improving the graphics, the physics didn't change a whole lot. What happens is the solar wind is composed of electrons and ions. It has a bulk flow of about 400 or so kilometers per sec. Typical temperatures of the electrons and ions are 10 electron volt or so. That 400 kilometers per sec is faster, much faster than the random motion of the ions. The ions are supersonic. As you flow by, you carve out a wake behind the moon. Ions can't get there. Electrons, the thermal motion of the electrons is much faster than the 400 kilometers per sec. So naively, electrons will come at all times, at all places. The bulks flow, that the solar wind is flowing, the solar wind electrons couldn't care less. The random motion is much faster than that. But you can't do that, can you? You can't really separate one type of charge from the other without building up large electric fields. So there's a lot of interest in what happens in the wake of the moon. There are several missions to answer all kinds of plasma physics. But in addition to the plasma flow, of course, you also, the UV ultraviolet radiation that has the photons have high enough energy that would liberate electrons from the surface. So naively, I expect that the day side is positively charged. The night side, where electrons have no excess, would be negative. I'm sorry, where ions have no excess, only electrons will have negative charges. And in a slide, I will give you a hand-waving argument how large that charging should be on the night side. You would look at it and say, oh, there is something really interesting will go on where positive and negative charge densities meet up and large horizontal electric fields can possibly be generated. Here is the night side. Imagine that an electron could come from any direction at all times. An ion would come by. But as you build up the negative charge density, at some point that ion has to be turned around in order to achieve any kind of a charge equilibrium. So if I more or less equate the thermal energy of an electron, that would give me a handle of what is the electron flux here, to the kinetic energy of a proton, you will end up with kilovolts. The night side, in order to turn back the 400 kilometers per sec proton and bring it to charge equilibrium, has to charge up to large negative values. There are lots of hiccups in this argument, but at least on the hand-waving level, you would see why large negative charge densities would be present on the night side. As far as dust goes, throughout the late 60s and early 70s, we have all kinds of puzzling issues. One is Surveyor 5, 6, and 7 were precursor missions to the Apollos. They were put on the surface. They had TV cameras. They were typically put towards the western direction for other reasons. And when the sunset happened, so by now the sun is behind the horizon, these strange bright clouds appear. There are no winds. There are no rivers. There is nothing that would move dust around. How on earth would you have a bright cloud of anything rising above the lunar surface? Apollo 17 left behind the lunar ejecta and meteorite experiment. I'm showing you hours from sunrise and the number of dust events they claim to be observing. Three sets of sensors, east, west, and the top of the box that's high above the lunar surface. Was recording every time sunrise and sunset happened. There's this crazy increase of fluxes. Something is going on. And the last piece is, of course, the sketches of the astronauts. They are the ones who stayed in the command module of the Apollos. They are on retrograde orbit. They are approaching the lunar sunrise. And they look at towards the sun. They are still in darkness, but anything that is high altitude, the sun would illuminate. First of all, they see these lenticular-shaped things. That's not very exciting, even though it must have been beautiful. That zodiacal dust, forward scattered light from zodiacal dust, that is in between the sun and the astronaut. But as you come closer to sunrise, you notice that some of that brightness appears to follow the lunar surface. Now, that doesn't make any sense. Why would zodiacal dust care about the lunar surface? Stranger yet, they see these bright streamers or really bright particles And by now I cannot do this demonstration. Some years ago we could have, when we had overhead projectors and chalk and eraser, and I would smack the eraser, there'd be a large cloud of chalk dust, and as you walk around, if you are sitting between the projector and the screen, you see all these bright flakes of stuff floating in the air. If you sit behind, you would see nothing. One Sunday lazy afternoon, you look through your window and the sun is shining in. It says, oh my God, I'm breathing all this stuff in. There is this incredible number of small dust particles, strongly forward scattering light. They appear to be very bright. So these people argue that these are streamers of small particles lifted from the surface, strongly forward scattering light, at heights of hundreds of kilometers above the lunar surface. And we argue about these ever since. All these pieces, and we could go through another couple of them, each of them has a series of possible explanations. There is one recurring theme that appears in all of these arguments and has to do with surface charging and plasma effects on the lunar surface. None of them alone would allow you to conclude, as the whole collection of observations is probably not enough. So one day, hopefully soon, we're going to make measurements and tell you if there is dust that high above the lunar surface or not. Another experiment, back to the lab, I would like to share with you, and I better hurry up. Imagine that now, instead of dust particles, we're going to shine light on a cesium surface that has a very low work function, so will emit electrons. And as a function of distance, I can measure the electron density. And these are electrons that are leaving the surface and leaving behind a positive charge and eventually returning to the surface. So in our colleagues who do atmospheric science, it's like an exosphere. Yeah, particles are coming and falling back to the surface. If you leave behind a positive charge density, you would actually measure an electric field that is pointing away from the positive charge density. Now imagine that we set this up such a way that we could push this surface back and forth. And now I will drop dust particles and measure the charge on the dust when it flies very close to the surface or when it goes and flies through very far from the surface. Very close to the surface, the most important collection is from the electrons that came from the surface, and the particle is negatively charged. Far away, the particle now is in a sea of electrons with much lesser of a density, and itself also emits electrons, so it will be positively charged. In between, I can't make measurements because it's really hard to measure zero charge. But I'm sure there is a transition between these two. Imagine I'm going to turn this experiment 90 degrees. Here it is. We have the plate. We put dust particles in it. We had to have a high-tech hammer to agitate the dust. And some particles will get caught in the plasma sheath. And here they are, beating gravity, this upward pointing electric field. If you are very close to the plate, your charge is negative, you would immediately fall down. If you manage to get high enough, your charge becomes positive because your own photoelectric emission, upward pointing electric field, positive charge, you could beat gravity and you could dance above the surface. You cannot get closer. If you were, you would immediately fall down. But at a certain height, you could actually dance in a plasma sheath. Some of this might or might not explain what we have seen on the moon. On the moon, of course, the story can be much more complicated because there is topography, and that's the physicist's description of a crater. I'm sure if you do impact physics, it can be much more complicated. We just took a crater and shined light on it and used the plasma simulation code, a PIC code, particles in cell code, to tell you what happens with the electrons and ions and what sort of a potential distribution you could generate just by shining light into a crater. So there is a complicated electric field distribution that is changing as the sun is rising and setting over the horizon. Now you could imagine that I'm going to take the daily changes in the electric field or potential distribution and start a homogeneously distributed dust density, fire particles, collect where they land, and I notice that after a day they start to preferentially land in the crater, and after 15 days or so, there's a whole lot of them in the crater, and you would say, that's curious. The dust
A crater works like a dust trap or a dust. Well, if you're a golfer, yes, like a trap. Likes to sit in the bottom of the craters. Then you would say, ah, that's unlikely that your distribution was flat to begin with. So I'm going to pile up all the dirt on one side. Let's start differently. Soon enough, all the dust would actually migrate towards and sit in the bottom of the craters. And you would say, that's curious. Do I have any evidence for this type of behavior? And possibly we do. This is the near satellite crashing into Eros, I believe. And you notice that these are the last couple of, one of the last images before it actually reached the surface. And the bottom of the craters appear to be incredibly smooth. Maybe that's all the dust that it accumulated. Another clue is actually our own moon. This is the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. It has an ultraviolet camera. And these images were done at night. The sun is not shining. The UV light that you see is reflected light from the solar system rather than directly from the sun. And then you look at these regions, and some of our colleagues who know the topography very well would recognize them, that these are permanently shadowed craters. These are regions, if there is ice on the moon, that's where ice should be. If there is ice, the albedo of ice is high. They should be bright, but they are dark. So once again, maybe what happens is the little dust accumulating over the flat ice would hide your ability to see. That's just one more image of crashing. And now I would like to change gears and tell you about what happens with dust on the lunar surface. In addition to the plasma effects, of course, the moon, as every other object, including the Earth, is continuously bombarded by dust from interplanetary space. Dust generated from comets and asteroids that wrongly decoupled from their source, slowly migrating towards the sun. The Earth is receiving about 100 tons every day of cosmic dust. These are the shooting stars when you look at the Perseids, or famous periods in the year when you see these particles coming in. But every day, 100 tons is coming in. If you translate that to the moon, there will be about 5 tons a day. Actually, the recognition that we have these ejecta clouds, particles that are generated in response to an impact, jumping up and falling down, really were first recognized in early 2000 by Galileo flying by the icy moons of Jupiter, because it had a dust detector. We never made this measurement at the moon. We never made this measurement anywhere else. The first time it was Galileo with a dedicated dust detector at Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. They all have these dust clouds. And if you take those models, we could work out what's the yield, the speed distribution, angular distribution of the ejecta, and we could build reasonable models how it works at an icy satellite. And we could make predictions, being very optimistic. What would happen if I exposed the moon to the impactors? What sort of an ejecta cloud would I see? And that's my most optimistic model, even cheating by an order of magnitude of the yield. And I'm still far off what I need to explain what the astronauts are claiming, how much brightness they have seen at the height of the command module. So in addition to ejecta, something else might go on. Maybe that's the effect of all these charging and lofting due to electrostatic effects. So I can build a simple-minded model and argue that everywhere you see this gradual drop in density of the ejecta clouds, and maybe at sunrise and sunset we have these small particles, and then I can put in a spacecraft that is roughly on an orbit of 30 by 100 kilometer, carefully arrange it such that closest point is at the morning terminator, and I mentally imagine, this is a page from a proposal from 2008 to NASA, if you allow me to build a detector which has 100 centimeter squared sensitive area, this is what I believe you would measure. You would measure particles that are reasonably large. They are the ejecta particles, and there's a gradual change along the orbit. This is local time. That's the sunrise. That's the sunset. That's sunrise, the early hours, 6 hours. That's where the spacecraft was closest to the surface. The density is highest. And that's the ejecta cloud. And then if I look at for the tiny particles at the morning and evening terminators, I expect large enhancements. So how can we measure? How can we measure small particles
what is the most sensitive way to make dust instruments to notice that a dust particle was hitting? And you have a slew of choices. Turns out that for the slow speeds that you would expect, your best choice is still impact ionization. The way it works, imagine a dust particle comes in, hits, in our case, a hemispherical target. The speed of 1.6 kilometers per sec is still high enough to make an impact cloud of electrons and ions. I set up an electric field. The electrons are all collected on the target. The ions are accelerated to a multi-channel plate. And I have the waveform of these impacts, and I can compare that to measurements in the lab. That's actually the working principle of the dust detector on Galileo, the dust detector on Ulysses, the dust detector on Cassini. Cassini is actually a bit more sophisticated, because if you hit the bottom part, a time of flight capability is built in, so you could tell me something about the composition of the dust. We don't have any chemical capability. The instrument I'm describing for the moon only can tell you the mass and the speed. It will not tell you composition. We built a dust accelerator in part to be able to develop this dust instrument. It's a 3 million volt electrostatic accelerator. Some of you might recall a Van de Graaff. This happens to be a Pellatron from Wisconsin, National Electrostatic Corporation. There's a 3 million volt potential drop between the two ends of this device. We have a little dust source. We charge particles positively, so field emission is not as much of a problem than it would be if you charge negatively. It's much easier to lose electrons than it is with ions. We can charge the particles. They fly down the beamline. We have a down-select capability. I will tell you precisely the mass and the speed, and then it goes into the impact chamber, and we can test our experiment or instruments. As a function of speed, 1 to 10 kilometers per sec, that's charge to mass ratio in units of coulombs per kilogram. This is how much charge you could generate. At the expected speed around the orbital speed around the moon, 1.7 kilometers per sec, a 0.3 micron particle would come in, well, in this case, I noted 2 kilometers per sec, would generate about 3,000 electrons. That's easy to detect. A 0.1 micron particle would generate only 200 electrons. That's hard to detect. That's hard to make a measurement in the lab. So the device that we built does the following. In an impact cloud, and you generated electrons and ions, we collect all the electrons on the target. And if the impact is big enough, that would be part of the measurement. The ions go into the multi-channel plate. If that signal rises at the threshold, I can tell you how big that particle was. Oftentimes, the particles are small, but there is hopefully a lot of them, that there is signal, but it's not enough to trigger individual detection. So we are also collecting those currents into an integrator, and every once in a while we read out how much charge we accumulated, even though none of them was big enough for single particle detection. Here is the waveform, for example. This is time in microseconds. That is the signal on the target. Notice that even before the particle hit, there is a beautiful drop, and then the rise of the cloud of electrons that we collect. That drop is a beautiful piece of physics. At the accelerator, I have huge charges on the dust particles. As they approach the hemispherical target, they induce an image charge. And I see that in the accelerator. I see that in my device. I see the image charge appearing and disappearing, and then I see the impact. And in nature, of course, in the solar wind and UV radiation, the charges will be much smaller than I can do at the accelerator. If the particles would be big enough, this process would also work, and I could, in addition to mass and speed, I will report the charge on the particle. And this booming big signal is on the multi-channel plate, that's why we use them. We set a threshold, and that's a signal that the ions produce. We tested, calibrated this instrument at the accelerator. This is speed, and this is the size of the particle, and these are our measurements. Notice at the accelerator, I don't have a total freedom, and there is a correlation between mass and speed. It has to do with energy being conserved. Half mv squared is the charge times the potential difference, so I cannot cover the whole space, but this is the region of interest around the moon. And you notice that we have black and red dots. The black and red dots are particles that the accelerator reported that it hit your instrument. And the red dots are the ones that I noticed. And the first time we have seen this, we got a heart attack because it turned out that we only detected about 65% of the incoming particles. Until it was a graduate student who pointed out or reminded all of us, wait a minute, you have three grids to keep out the solar wind. Each grid has a 90% transparency, and your duty cycle is 90%, and if I take the force power of 0.9, you get 65%. So it is working exactly as it's supposed to, and we can measure down to 0.3 microns at the relevant speed. This instrument has a good likelihood of working well. This is now the collective signal. The problem with the collective signal, a lot of small particles produce as you would fly over the terminator. Imagine that from night you are flying to the day side. The ultraviolet radiation reaching my instrument is also increasing. How would I know that the background current I measure is dust or UV? So what we do is 1 second every 10, we'll make this instrument blind to dust. That electric field that would accelerate the ions towards the multi-channel plate is reversed. Photons don't care. Whatever photons scatter into the multi-channel plate will still get in there. Dust signal is cut out. Dust will not make a contribution. And then we go back to normal mode, so we can measure our own background. It turns out that the transition of switching the directionality of the electric field brings in some spurious signals, but the green dots are the 9 seconds out of every 10, and the blue dots are the 1 second every 10. And this was done in the vacuum chamber when we turn on the vacuum gauge, which is an ion source. And turns out that was good enough for me to verify that this background subtraction scheme would work. This is the signal that, based on the model, I expect 6 minutes before sunrise. You see these big impacts that happen one at a time. I will probably detect them. And the contribution from a lot of small particles is hidden in the rising envelope where the big impacts are sitting on top of. If I see this, I can tell you there's a lot of dust. I cannot detect them one at a time, but I can tell you that that population is there. So, there's a whole lot of effort in addition to building the machine. How do you set all the parameters? It's a short mission. So we invested a whole lot of time and energy to have quick look tools that the data comes on and I can immediately decide if any of my parameters needs to be changed. These are the waveforms now imitating, actually taking the data at the accelerator and turned it in as it was observed in orbit about the moon, and develop our ability to make quick decisions if the setup needs to be changed or not. This is a page from one of these NASA reviews, and the requirements are laid out. This is the instrument we're going to deliver, and then hopefully the check marks are real, at least to the best of our ability. From the lab test, I can tell you that everything we promised to NASA, the instrument will in fact do. I don't want to read through. I will give you the slides. This is the instrument that we built. Actually, this is at Ames. This is in June, early June this year. This is already the top deck of the instrument. It was up. We are already integrated to the spacecraft. These lines are nitrogen purge, or target is being purged at all times to avoid any sort of condensation of anything. It's a very costly setup. The hemispherical target is machined to 5 nanometer RMS to build as good a UV mirror as we can, carefully choosing the focus of that mirror above the multi-channel plate. So minimize the scatter of ultraviolet photons into the multi-channel plate. So we try to keep it clean. These are the grids that you see to keep out electrons and ions from the solar wind, and that's the hemispherical target. And it was one of the last tests for door opening and closing. It's a one-time opening, no closing. It's manual closing. Now this is in actually the end of, actually mid-August at Wallops, Virginia. That's the Lottie spacecraft. You don't see us, that's on the top of the spacecraft, sharing the top deck with two other instruments, a neutron mass spectrometer and an ultraviolet imaging camera. We also have a laser communication demonstration that's not part of the science payload, but at times where funding was in question, it was good to have a technology demonstration, and when they were in trouble, it was good for them to argue for science. So we could go through the laws and ups or ups and downs of funding.
This is actually early September. We are stacked on the top of the orbital spacecraft. That little thingy up there is bloody, already in the fairings. And September 6th, and this is the image you probably all have seen, the little froggy. Apparently it's real. That's 11:30, Friday, September 6th at Wallops Island. By now the spacecraft is on these big phasing loops. We are somewhere here. The instrument checkout started. We missed ours because of the flooding in Boulder. You must have seen the news. We couldn't travel to Goddard. Our first checkout will happen this coming Saturday. The way it will work is after these three big loops, we are at the moon and at the right place at the right time to be caught into a retrograde orbit, just exactly like the Apollos. Of course, for that, we have to have a big burn to lose energy and switch over from Earth's gravity domination to lunar. And this beautiful orb set is the same same orbits in such a way that I kept the moon in that position. It's pretty celestial dynamics how you get to the moon. It takes 30 days because, contrary to Apollo 3 days, we are spending incredible small amount of fuel to get from the Earth to the moon. So here it is. Hopefully we start measurements in about a month and a half in lunar orbit. That's the instrument we built, and maybe at some point I will have a chance to tell you about it. For now, maybe the take-home message is that dust and plasma is an interesting medium to work with. There's a lot of interesting physics, and if you are doing anything with spacecraft, when you are combining in situ and remote sensing, that's the way to go. There's a lot of the sum of instruments is much, much more than the contribution of any single instrument can possibly make. If you are making field measurements, electric fields, magnetic fields, electrons and ions, you have to be mindful about the dust possibly interfering with what you think you are measuring. And LADEE is good to go. The next best thing, in addition to making measurements on orbit, of course, one day to make measurements on the lunar surface, and there is a number of nations that will hopefully go and succeed with their plans to put measurements on the surface. I'd like to stop.